The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Diane Ackerman received an MA and an MFA and a PhD from Cornell University as a poet. It's quite wonderful. She lives in the mythical town of Ithaca, New York, which is also a real place. Her works of nonfiction include, most recently, The Zookeeper's Wife, A Tale of People, Animals, and Subversive Acts of Compassion. The Zookeeper's Wife was recently awarded the 2008 Orion Book Award, which is conferred annually to a book that deepens our connection to the natural world, presents new ideas about our relationship with nature, and achieves excellence in writing. The committee's chairperson, Kathleen Dean Moore, said, "A few years ago, nature writers were asking themselves, how can a book be at the same time a work of art, an act of conscientious objection to the destruction of the world, and an affirmation of hope and human decency? The Zookeeper's Wife answers this question." Diane Ackerman's other works of nonfiction include An Alchemy of Mind, A Poetics of the Brain based on the latest neuroscience, Cultivating Delight, A Natural History of My Garden, Deep Play, which considers play, creativity, and our need for transcendence, A Slender Thread about her work as a crisis line counselor, The Rarest of the Rare, and The Moon by Whale Light, in which she explores the plight and fascination of endangered animals. A Natural History of Love, On Extended Wings, her memoir of flying, and the bestseller, A Natural History of the Senses. Her poetry has been published by many literary journals, and she also writes nature books for children. She's received many prizes and awards, and she's been honored as a literary lion, which is great because she loves animals, by the New York Public Library. This is the first time I've ever interviewed anyone who also has the rare distinction of having a molecule named after her, Diane Ackerman. So that is quite thrilling. I also want to thank the Polish consulate tonight for helping to get out the word on this and supporting this event. Paulina Kapuscinska is here. Thank you very much from the Polish consulate. And now please welcome Diane Ackerman to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Welcome to have you back.
Well, thank you.
Since you did mention the molecule.
Please, tell us.
It's a sex pheromone in crocodiles.
Ah.
I thought you might want to know.
And you were very happy about it, right?
Oh, yes.
Were you given choices? Were there other molecules?
Oh, no. No, I had just been out in the field sexing alligators and crocodiles and their kin for various reasons. And none of them prurient. And there were some chemists who had found this molecule. They thought it was rather sporting of me. And so they just named it after me.
Here I thought it was like a twinkling star.
I know, that's why I had to tell you.
Okay. Well, we're going to, our main subject that we're going to talk about tonight is The Zookeeper's Wife, and talking about, which is a war story set in the Warsaw Ghetto, in the zoo in the Warsaw Ghetto. It's an extraordinary book. I love this book so much. It's a book which brings together history in a very novel way, history and natural science and Diane's own skill as a poet to interpret all of these pieces and bring them together into a very, very rich tapestry. I thought we would start by talking, just giving some statistics, kind of, you know, talking about the Warsaw under German occupation. And I thought I would start with this quote from Gunnar Paulsen's book, Secret City. He writes that, and these are just some statistics to bear in mind as we think about these heroic people and the work they did in rescuing Jews in the villa, in the zoo. He wrote, 98% of the Jewish population of Warsaw perished in the Second World War, together with 1/4 of the Polish population. In all, some 720,000 souls, a number that dwarfs the destruction of life in Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined, and is undoubtedly the greatest slaughter perpetrated within a single city in human history. He goes on to say, the flight of 20-odd thousand Jews from the Warsaw ghetto seems by comparison a negligible phenomenon and has passed almost unnoticed by historians. Yet it was probably the greatest mass escape from confinement in history, and the life of those refugees in hiding for anything from 1.5 to more than 4 years is a dramatic story that has few parallels.
Yes, I think that very few people appreciate how many people it took to make it possible for any one person to escape. And not just the people who were actively involved, like the zookeepers, but the people who were tacitly involved. The postman who didn't tell anyone, the delivery people, the maid. You know, so many people came in and out of their lives and for various reasons decided not to turn them in.
The statistic that he cites is one of the estimates is that there were 28,000 Jews in hiding and 70,000 to 90,000 people helping them to make that possible. Which brings to mind, as you're saying, Eva Hoffman writes, you know, it took many people to hide one Jew. But it only took one to betray many.
Yeah.
So that was also part of the calculus of how it's remembered, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
Part of the trauma. Tell us what drew you to this story to begin with and how you discovered it. You lucky writer, you. It must have been just such a great coming together of author and story.
Well, my grandparents came from Poland. And my grandfather told me that he seemed to recall there was this strange primeval forest. And I thought that sounded interesting, and that there were ancient animals running around in it. And not too long after that, I proposed to National Geographic, whom I'd been doing some work for, that I go to Białowieża and this extraordinary forest, and that I write about these ancient-seeming horses. And it just happened that instead they wanted me to go to the South Pacific to do something. But then over the next 15 years, I kept my fascination and little tidbits kept adding up. It turned out that there weren't just these horses that looked like the ones that the Neolithic hunters had painted on the cave walls, but that there were ancient bison running around there too and other animals, and that Jan Żabiński, who was the head of the Warsaw Zoo during World War II, was the world's authority on them, that his wife was adopting animals, orphan animals, from this forest, and that somehow all of this had to do with Nazi perversity. So bit by bit, it became more and more fascinating to me. And then there is this element, sometimes in Yiddish they say that something is beshirt. I just happened to have a neighbor who spent her first 26 years in Poland, Catholic. She didn't know until we started working on this book together, because she became my translator, that in her own family there was a rescuer, one of her uncles. She did know that one of her other uncles had been a vet at the zoo before the war.
Wow.
And so we got in touch with him through the wonders of email, and he remembered that Antonina had perhaps kept a diary, published maybe a memoir long out of print. So we sent him around to all of the used bookstores in Warsaw.
So you found it?
He found it and sent it. Yes, my neighbor translated it for me. And at that point, when I began to see what an unbelievable sensibility she had, what a sense of compassion and vision and what a kindred soul, her relationship with her animals made her. I just found it irresistible. I had to write about it. And then at that point, as you well know, the real research begins.
Well, let's. I don't know, how many of you have actually read Diane's book already? So quite a few. And how many of you haven't read it? So let's set up the situation a little bit for those who don't know. First of all, we have the zoo, the Warsaw Zoo. We have this couple who live there. But also we have Warsaw under German occupation. And we thought we would maybe start with what they were up against. What was what did it mean? Why was the occupation in Poland so particularly brutal?
Well, Hitler had decided that he was going to single out the Poles for special treatment, partly because they were such ferocious resistors and fighters, but I think mainly for racist reasons, because it wasn't just the Jews that he wanted to obliterate. He also wanted to get rid of all Slavs, as well as gypsies and homosexuals and Catholics and just all kinds of people. But he wanted to make the Slavs a kind of underling class, a servant class, and he needed Poland, he felt, for Lebensraum. So the plan...
Explain what Lebensraum is.
Yeah, he felt that the Germans needed more room to live in. And the way they were going to do this and have more resources is that they were going to invade a country like Poland. They were going to drive the farmers off the land and then give the land over to the German farmers. And I think what very few people appreciate is that he didn't just want to indulge in ethnic cleansing of humans. He also planned on ripping up all of the so-called Slavic crops and replacing them with German crops, pure Aryan crops, he said. And the same thing was true of the animals. His plan was to change the DNA of the entire planet. And perhaps in the most sophisticated way, he had begun to do that in Poland.
The consequences for rescuing were extreme, the risks that people, people took. And I'll just read this little part from your book. Or maybe you want to, it's on page 69, the new German colony to be ruled by Hans Frank, who was the the new German, Hitler's personal lawyer.
The city quickly spasmed into German hands. Banks closed, salaries dried up. Antonina and Jan moved back to the villa, but stripped of money and supplies, they scavenged for food left by the Polish soldiers who had billeted there. The new German colony was ruled by Hitler's personal lawyer, Hans Frank, an early member of the Nazi Party and a leading jurist, busy revising German laws according to Nazi philosophy, especially racist laws and those aimed at the resistance. During his first month in office, Governor General Frank declared that, quote, any Jew leaving the district to which they have been confined would be killed, as would people who deliberately offer a hiding place to such Jews. Instigators and helpers are subject to the same punishment as perpetrators. An attempted act will be punished in the same way as a completed act. Yeah, not only would the person in question be killed, but the extended family would be killed, sometimes neighbors, in some cases whole villages. It was guilt by association.
So Antonina and Jan, who are both the zookeepers and quite remarkable people, they had one son at the time, and they later had another daughter, too, during the war, right?
They did. And perhaps I should explain for those of you who haven't read the book that the zoo really was the cultural center of Warsaw at this time, or it was designed to be. They were having concerts there. It was a brand new zoo. It was a fabled place where fairy tales came alive, you know, the fairy tales that really came out of those European forests. And these were very happily married young people. And all of a sudden, the war broke out. They could well have survived the war without doing anything, certainly without risking the life of their young son. But they were so disgusted by Nazi racism that they decided that they would turn the zoo into a sanctuary. And that meant they were going to have to deceive the Germans for years on end. But they did manage to do it in very ingenious ways.
And even though it's so ingenious, and even though you describe it in such incredible detail, it still staggers the imagination to believe that they pulled it off.
It really does, because the villa, which was right in the middle of the zoo grounds, was in that very modernist style. It was almost entirely glass. It was all windows. There were German troops walking all around all the time. They were hiding people in plain sight. They would smuggle people out of the ghetto and into the lion's cage, and then underground into the pheasant's cage, and then they'd wait until dark, and they'd move some of the people into the cellar of the house, and they would be hidden between the walls and in different places. But for the most part, people were hidden in the animal houses. And after the zoo was bombed and a lot of the animals were gone, the people were given the code names of the animals that had once lived in the houses.
But the animals also had the names of people.
The animals were given the names of people. The people were given the names of animals. And because Antonina also never could turn away an orphan animal, she was an orphan herself, and even during the war, and she had her house full of all of these illegal people, the zoo full of all of these people, sometimes 50 at a time, nonetheless, she kept raising very, very eccentric wild animals inside the house at the same time. So the animals with human names, the humans with animal names, the wild animals running around the house, the underground gave the zoo the code name of the house under a crazy star.
And you really fall in love with these animals. I mean, we're talking badgers and otters, and I mean, this.
Oh, I love the badger.
I love the badger too.
The badger was very special. The little boy had most of the animals just sleep under the covers with him at night, and this was especially true for a baby badger. And one day, when Antonina couldn't find badgers, she went looking in all of badgers' usual sleeping places, you know, in the closets and drawers and different places, and last thing, she thought to look under her son's bed, and she lifted up the sheet, the edge of the sheet, just in time to see Badger pushing the little boy's training potty out into the open and climbing on board and using it as it was intended. And the house was like this all the time.
Yeah, the animals got bolder and bolder, too. Who is it that became we'll read about V-check later.
The predatory, carnivorous rabbit.
The fat, furry thug. But
yes.
First, which I now call my cat. But first, let's talk about the characters and their special affinity with animals that
yes.
Jan and Antonina had. Antonina, you described as having almost this shamanistic quality with animals.
She really did.
Her ability to communicate with them. And this is what you're drawing both from other people's testimony about her and also her own writing.
Every time somebody speaks in the book, I'm quoting directly. Also, any time I have somebody thinking something, I'm quoting directly either from their own writings or from interviews that had been done with them. And she said that she had a kind of mystical relationship with animals for her entire life. She knew how to calm them. She knew how they were sensing the world. She had enormous respect for them. And after the war, she wrote quite a few children's books from the perspective of animals, right inside the sensibility, especially of mother animals. And she was just very keenly attuned to them, but then so was Jan. He was a zoologist. And after the war, most people in Poland got to know him from his weekly radio shows in which he would talk about the lives of animals.
Now, you wrote in the book about how, in both cases, in terms of them surviving the war and their ability to do what they had to do as rescuers, their affinity with animals really, in a sense, equipped them for these survival skills. And there's a passage, I think on 24, you talked about reading, which talks about some of the qualities that Antonina took on. Maybe you could read that, about her identification with animals.
There was something alchemical about living so intimately with the likes of lion kitten, wolf cub, monkey toddler, and eagle chick, as the animal smells, scratchings, and calls mingled with human body and cooking smells, with human chatter and laughter in a mixed family of den mates. At first, a new member of the household slept or fed on its old schedule, but gradually the animals began to live in synchrony as their rhythms drew closer together. Not their breathing, though, and at night, the sleepy tempo of breaths and snufflings created a zoological cantata hard to score. Antonina identified with animals, fascinated by how their senses tested the world. She and Jan soon learned to slow around predators like wildcats because close-set eyes give them pinpoint depth perception, and they tend to get excited by quick movements a leap or two away. Prey animals like horses and deer enjoy wraparound vision to spot predators creeping up on them. but panic easily. The lame speckled eagle tethered in their basement was essentially a pair of binoculars with wings. The hyena pups would have spotted Antonina coming in total darkness. Other animals could sense her approach, taste her scent, hear the faintest swoosh of her robe, feel the weight of her footsteps vibrating the floorboards a whisker's worth, even detect the motes of air she pushed aside. She envied their array of ancient, finely tuned senses, a human gifted with those ordinary talents Westerners would call a sorcerer.
And I think really, even though these are human beings, you know, they are such human beings, I mean, what they did was a kind of sorcery. I mean, to hide, literally when you use the phrase hiding someone in plain sight.
Yes.
I mean, it is a kind
of... It's camouflage, yeah. And they understood, who better than zoologists to know how to camouflage people. And also because they truly just thought of humans as animals and animals as other forms of humans, they treated everybody and every creature in very much the same way, and they studied them in the same way. And I'm sure that that's why they were able to bring such competence to dealing with the enemies, because they really... They could judge them well. They could anticipate them well.
I think one of the, you know, with all the horrors going on simultaneously in the ghetto that you allude to and describe in the book, one of the most horrifying, you know, scenes is when she's lying, Antonina is lying in bed with her son at night, comforting him, and the Germans are kind of going on a drunken shooting spree in the zoo.
They're shooting the few remaining animals that are left. Yes, there was... the head of the Berlin Zoo, Lutz Heck, who in cahoots with Goering and Hitler decided after the war that Hitler would need pure Aryan horses to ride and pure Aryan bison to hunt and, of course, a pristine wilderness. And all of these things existed in Poland. And so he went to the zoo essentially to take control of it and to steal the best animals for breeding stock and used the imprimatur of the zoo to have his way in Poland. And he claimed to be their friend and that he would look after them and that the animals he was taking really were just on loan. But, of course, he was stealing them. And then one day, much to her horror, he came back with Gestapo friends. They were all drunk, they were armed, and they just went on a rampage, shooting the animals that remained, yeah.
Which was just an echo of what they were doing in the ghetto at the same time.
Just so.
Yeah. Would you read the passage? It's quite a remarkable passage about the bombing of the zoo. It starts on chapter 6. This is some writing, I tell you.
What page?
It's on the beginning of chapter 6 on 61. Because also, Diane, you've made, since we build this identification with the animals, I think it makes these passages all the more when you're reading the book. You know, they're very visceral to the reader.
This is a very hard passage for me to write, as you can imagine. Nazi bombers attacked Warsaw in 1,150 sorties, devastating the zoo, which happened to lie near anti-aircraft guns. On that clear day, the sky broke open and whistling fire hurtled down. Cages exploded. Moats rained upward. Iron bars squealed as they wrenched apart. Wooden buildings collapsed, sucked down by heat. Glass and metal shards mutilated skin, feathers, hooves, and scales indiscriminately as wounded zebras ran, ribboned with blood. Terrified howler monkeys and orangutans dashed caterwauling into the trees and bushes. Snakes slithered loose, and crocodiles pushed onto their toes and trotted at speed. Bullets ripped open the aviary nets, and parrots spiraled upward like Aztec gods and plummeted straight down. Other tropicals hid in the shrubs and trees or tried to fly with singed wings. Some animals, hiding in their cages and basins, became engulfed by rolling waves of flame. Two giraffes lay dead on the ground, legs twisted, shockingly horizontal. The clotted air hurt to breathe and stank of burning wood, straw, and flesh. The monkeys and birds, screeching infernally, created an otherworldly chorus backed by a crackling timpani of bullets and bomb blasts. Echoing around the zoo, the tumult surely sounded like 10,000 furies scratching up from hell to unhinge the world. Yeah, Antonina writes a little bit about this and some of the actual ways in which the animals move I was able to put in just from my own observation. So, for example, the crocodiles. We mentioned earlier about crocodiles, and I'd been studying them, so I knew that they pushed up on their toes, and they trotted when they ran away. And so very often in the book, I layered in the natural history observations that she would have seen taking place.
You know, it's kind of in the back of my mind, too, when I read it, was, the recent sortie into, in the last couple of years into Baghdad. I mean, we have these images of zoos and warfare. It's just such a potent image,
It really is the killing of the innocents.
Yeah, and as a mirror for what's going on. So let's talk about what's going on in the ghetto at the same time. So here they have the villa set up. They're under occupation. Things are tightening in the ghetto. Now, one of your main sources, I believe, is the amazing Emanuel Ringelbaum archive. Let's talk a little bit about that and explain what that is. It's an amazing source.
Yes, people hid their accounts of what was going on, their eyewitness accounts. They hid them, and they were found after the war. Before the war, in the ghetto, they were hidden, a lot of them, in the back of a sofa in one of the offices there. And a great many of these documents survived. So I ended up reading a lot of these eyewitness accounts. They're quite harrowing, of course. But they also give you so much detail about what everyday life was like.
Including,
exactly.
I was reading the Ringelbaum archive in the diary, his diary this morning and preparing. And I mean, even jokes, the blackest jokes of all jokes are in this book. I mean, just the texture of life.
The texture of life.
Every aspect of the texture of life, to a child freezing on the sidewalk, to the joke that's going around about, it's quite extraordinary. So he supplied a lot of these eyewitness accounts, and they were also put into milk cans.
They were put into milk cans. One of the things about history in general is that it tends to record the life of the upper class, because those were the people who had the leisure and the education and the wherewithal to set down their accounts. In this situation, we had just unbelievable textural description, sensory description of everyday life in the ghetto.
And Ringelbaum, who was a historian by training, he was 39, I think, when the war started, he had several opportunities to get out of the ghetto, to leave, and he felt like it was his duty to stay to the end and record everything that was going on.
There were a number of people who were given the opportunity to leave and who chose to stay. Rabbi Shapira was one of them, and I was surprised that this Hasidic rabbi was encouraging his flock to practice what we would now call mindfulness meditation as a way to transcend, to meditate on the beauties of nature. There was the head of the orphanage, Korshak, who was essentially doing the same thing with the children. He was putting on theater. He was teaching them to do mindful collecting of the dishes. And whatever they could possibly do to transcend a kind of horror that could not be absorbed, that could not be digested. And Antonina, in her own way, was doing a similar thing. She was insistent not just that people survive, but that they survive with dignity and grace, that they survive with their humanity intact. And to that end, she filled her house with the innocent distractions of all of these crazy animals. She brought everybody out after dark, and they had piano concerts. This seems to me absolutely impossible.
And she signaled there were certain songs that she would play that would, if someone was coming, that was of danger. And I love also how you stop and, give us a sense. So she's playing Offenbach, and then you explain, this was a Jewish composer,
right?
And
that
so
itself.
that was the code. But also Korshak and all of these great characters who come up, you really kind of take us into who they are in relation to this story, and you do it so seamlessly. Yeah, it's really wonderful.
I was very moved by their stories, by the stories of people who could leave and felt that they had to stay. In the same way that I was very moved by reading accounts of a whole variety of rescuers who were interviewed after the war, and to a person, they say, oh, I didn't do anything special, I wasn't very heroic. I did what anyone would do in that situation. It was just the right thing to do.
Well, since you've alluded to the furry menagerie, I think you have to read something about one of my favorite animals in the book, who is the fat furry thug. Let's see, where is Vichek? It begins on 163.
I think he's probably my favorite, too.
He's a pretty great character.
Although I do like that they had a cat in the house, and for various reasons, whenever the cat, who, as Antonina put it, would get married very often, whenever the cat would have kittens, the kittens would be removed almost immediately and replaced with newborn baby foxes.
By the fox man. Another eccentric character.
Yes, who lived in the house and who was head of the fur farm where they were raising foxes. And the cat, of course, was confused. You know, after all, these kittens would bark, which was unusual. And the house would be full of baby foxes absolutely everywhere, and thinking they could jump the same way that a cat could jump, because she would be teaching them the only way she knew how. And so they would be curled up like little soup tureens all over the house, these little foxes. But then additionally, there was Vichek. Even with the guests, and that's guests with a capital G, that was the way that she thought of the people who were sheltering there. Even with the guests and the relatives gone, the wintry villa included two eccentric tenants. And according to Antonina, the first to arrive, Vichek, belonged to an aristocratic family of impeccable lineage. His mother was a member of a famous line of silver rabbits known as Arctic hares, a breed whose young start out glossy black and silver up later on as they pale into adolescence. October's wet gales made Vichek shiver in a garden hutch, so Antonina brought him indoors to the relative warmth of the dining room by day and Rish's heavily blanketed bed at night. Each morning, while Rish dressed for school, Vichek slid from between the bed covers and hopped along the hallway to the stairwell, then carefully descended to the narrow steps and nosed open the wooden divider to scurry into the dining room, where he nestled beside the stove's glass door. There he flattened his long ears against his back for added warmth and stretched one rear leg straight out while tucking the other three in tight. Naturally gifted with amber eyes outlined in black like Egyptian hieroglyphics, three layers of fur, large snowshoe feet, and extra long incisors for gnawing moss and lichen, he quickly developed habits and tastes unknown to rabbit culture and a bizarre griffin-like personality. At first, whenever Rish sat down to dinner, Vichek draped himself along Rish's foot like one furry black slipper, instinctively crouching as hares do in Arctic windstorms. Then, as Vichek grew large and muscular, he bounced around the house like hard rubber, and at meals hopped from the floor straight onto Rish's lap, thrust his front paws onto the table, and grabbed Rish's food. Naturally vegetarian, Arctic hares may resort to tree bark and pine cones at times, but Vichek preferred stealing a horse cutlet or slice of beef and bouncing away to devour it in a shadowy corner. According to Antonina, he'd zoom into the kitchen whenever he heard the thud of her meat tenderizing hammer, hop onto a stool, leap from there to the table, and snatch a slice of raw meat, then dart away with his trophy and feast like a small panther. During the holidays, when a friend sent the Zhubinskys a gift of kielbasa, Vichek became a razor-toothed pest, begging for scraps and mugging anyone he found eating sausage. In time, he also discovered cold cuts hidden atop a piano in Jan's office next to the kitchen. In theory, the piano's slippery legs deterred hungry mice, not so hungry hares. With all his pilfering, Vichek quickly grew into a fat, furry thug, and whenever they left the house, they jailed him behind a corner cupboard since he'd begun eating their clothes. One day, he chewed the collar of Jan's jacket hanging on a chair in the bedroom. Another, he scalloped a felt hat and hemmed a visitor's coat. They joked about his being an attack rabbit. But in a more solemn mood, Antonina wrote that wherever she turned in the human or animal world, she found shocking and unpredictable behavior.
Such a great quote. There was, in the ghetto at the same time, a famous entomologist, a collector and science...
Tannenbaum, yes.
Who was studying insects and was confined in the ghetto. His whole collection was moved to the villa, correct?
Yes.
And how did it get there? Jan was able to take it out for safekeeping? That was the...
Yes, he had put it there actually before the war for safekeeping.
They were college friends, right?
They were friends, yes. They had worked together, and they were very long-time friends. And they had known each other since they were very young. And Jan had always loved insects, too, and he had even done a cockroach study of his own. And Simon went into the ghetto thinking that this was probably as safe as any other place at the time. But he didn't know what was going to happen to the insects, and so they stayed at the villa, and there were 500,000 of these insects in this collection. And one day, Jan and Antonina heard somebody at the door, and to their surprise, there was a German named Ziegler who said that he had come to see the insect collection of Tannenbaum's. And they thought, oh, we're in trouble now. We're really in trouble. But as it turned out, Ziegler really, truly was someone who just loved insects, really loved insects, and had become a close friend of Tannenbaum's and would pay visits on him in the ghetto. Ziegler worked in a labor bureau whose building happened to back right onto the ghetto wall, and there was a door that led from his building into the ghetto. So it wasn't the front door, but in theory, you could go to and fro. And Jan knew this, and so he exploited Ziegler to be able to go in and out of the ghetto. He said he would need to go there to consult with Tannenbaum to make sure that nothing bad happened to the insects. And it didn't take Jan very long to discover that Ziegler had a serious rapture for insects. He just studied him as he would study any other creature, as he held up one box of these insects after another, and he just got lost in them, Ziegler, and explained that he really needed to make sure nothing bad happened to them. He was completely obsessed with them.
And that was a way that Jan was able to smuggle people.
It was
out
the essential way for
the
him.
The essential way that he was able to.
Yeah, Jan, I think, from what I've read of his interviews, found it exciting. He knew he was doing the right thing, but he also found it thrilling, dangerous, risky, edgy to be smuggling people out in this way. And it was very theatrical. He had to play many roles, and he did it very expertly, and he began smuggling people out one at a time.
Do you think Ziegler was actually turning a blind eye to him smuggling?
I do. There was never any evidence that was offered by Antonina or by Jan, but I can't see how it could have been otherwise.
And I was telling Diane just earlier that I had just read in the Ringelbaum book today that Ziegler actually died in Auschwitz. He had reported a rape in the ghetto, and it says, Ringelbaum writes, he was supposedly thanked for his discovery later when the opportunity offered itself, arrested and sent to Auschwitz.
Yeah, and I'm sure that they were just looking for some excuse, really, when they knew how sympathetic he was.
I was surprised too, when you were talking about the German ethnic cleansing. When you talked about Konrad Lorenz, that he had written,
yes,
so disappointing.
It's very disappointing. I always used to quote Konrad Lorenz on the honeybee, you know, this endless well, and you can dip into it for knowledge, and it's constantly refilling, like all of nature. But I had not understood the extent to which he had become Nazified. Mm. And he just towed party lines. A lot of German scientists did.
Would you read, before we open to questions, I thought it would be a nice one to end on, the about the insect collection that was saved. It also is such a beautiful passage and a great metaphor in itself.
Where is this?
It's on 151.
Is this, you'd like me to start with...
How about an insect collection is a silent oasis down at the bottom?
An insect collection is a silent oasis in the noisy clamor of the world, isolating phenomena so that they can be seen undistractedly. In that sense, what is being collected are not the bugs themselves, but the deep attention of the collector. That is also a rarity, a sort of gallery that ripples through the mind and whose real holdings are the perpetuation of wonder in a maelstrom of social and personal distractions. Collection is a good word for what happens, because one becomes collected for a spell, gathering up one's curiosity the way rainwater collects. Every glass-faceted box holds a sample of a unique collector's high regard, and that's partly why people relish studying them, even if they know all the bug parts by heart. So it doesn't really matter where the boxes sit, but Simon would have enjoyed this end-of-the-lane, out-of-the-way place, surrounded by farm fields and dense foliage, a skitter with insects, tiny beetles abounding, where his golden zarka could chase birds and moles, a dachshund's prerogative. One often recognizes only in hindsight a coincidence or unlikely object that altered fate. Who would have imagined that a zealous professor's cavalcade of pinned beetles would open the gate from the ghetto for so many people? It was absolutely thrilling to find the remnants of this collection. For the longest time, I just couldn't find it. Nobody knew where it was. And then ultimately, I ran it down about an hour outside of Warsaw, about an hour south, in a tiny village. It's so small, I think it must be an ort. I don't even think it's a village. And there were just kind of metal buildings, trailers, that were held the overflow from one of the natural history museums. And in there, sure enough, there were these extraordinary boxes, which is how I came to be able to describe what they looked like.
So they're marked as Zeman Tannenbaum's collection?
Oh, yes.
They are.
They are. With everything else that is higgledy-piggledy, you know, stored in this... curiosity cabinet of a trailer that's out there, and they are marked as Tannenbaum, and they're all given numbers, and you can look and see how carefully, how lovingly he pinned them, and he wrote what his handwriting was like, and how Ziegler would have been able to hold up the boxes, and how the rosin that had been painted on the boxes was still glowing. Mm. You could see what the experience of holding them was like.
So, Diane, you have so many elements. Just talk a little bit about the process of this. So here you have the beetle collection, and you have the rabbit, and you have what's going on. It's a really great bibliography, too. I mean, it's such a great work of scholarship, too, but it's so alive. How long did you work on it, and you know, how did you work with these different layers of information?
I worked on it for about 3 years, and yes, what I did was layer things in. So in what I read about Vicek, of course I had to learn about Arctic hares. First I had to figure out what kind of rabbit it was. And I could tell from the description of how it changed color and so on that it was an Arctic hare. And then I found out how Arctic hares settle, how they hide themselves in the snow. So in that little passage where the hare has that one leg out and it's kind of tucked up and it's lying in a certain way, that's from reading natural history about how they do poise, you know, like that. And I just kept tucking in little details because I love that. I love learning those things. I was able to go to the villa, which stands in the middle of the zoo, and lie down in Antonina's bedroom and stand on the balcony and look out at Old Town, which looks pretty similar because it was rebuilt on the basis of architectural drawings from the Renaissance. So I could see very much what she was seeing. I could see the river, smell the river, hear the bridges. I could trace her pathway through the city, find the trees that she would have passed that were older than the war, that were still standing. There were so many things. There were linden trees that surrounded her at that time, and there are still linden trees in Prasky Park, which is right beside the zoo.
And I happened to be there when the lindens were in bloom. Mm. So I could
I'm so
smell
allergic
which,
to those.
Are you? They're very, very pungent.
They blow. You can see
they really do.
Yeah.
And you hear the loudest bees, you know, these tribes of bees up there buzzing away. But all of these things are things that would have surrounded her too. And her senses were very keen, so she would have paid attention. So I studied the navigation patterns of the birds during 1939 and 1940 and so on over Poland, and what kinds of animals and plants would have come into bloom and what would have surrounded her. Some of the most fun that I had was researching the sounds that the different animals in her zoo made first thing in the morning.
Yeah, the cacophony that you, the fugue that you described.
That
you said that would be hard to score.
Be very hard to score, but oddly enough, you can hear each individual animal or pair on the internet, or you can go to the zoo and you can hear them.
What was the longest period of time you spent in Warsaw for your research? I mean, at any time?
Only a few weeks.
A few weeks at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So you were able to do a lot of the research just from researching from your from
Absolutely.
Ithaca.
And as I say, I was also lucky to have this friend who had grown up there. And her mother and her aunt, both of whom I interviewed, had been girl messengers for the underground during the war.
Beshared. It was definitely
It was beshared.
The whole thing was meant to be.
Yes, I could say to them, okay, so during the uprising, what did the air smell like? What happened to the dogs and cats? Were there any birds overhead? What did you hear? What songs were being sung? What did people wear? I could ask them all of those kinds of questions. I was able to look at a lot of family photographs, and that was helpful. That's how I could tell that Jan had a very hairy left arm and that he wore his wristwatch on the left, and things like that.
Yeah, well, you know? It makes it a really extraordinary book to read, really, really does. And we'll open it up to you so you can ask this wonderful author some questions. So, and see, there's two microphones. If we have questions, how about down here first?
I have a few questions. First of all, did all of this happen to the animals after the bombing of the zoo?
A lot happened, yes, after the bombing of the zoo. Some animals survived.
If so, where do they get the food to feed all the animals and the people?
A lot of the food that they had been receiving before the war, the food sellers continued to supply small installments of while the war was going on. And also they would do things like trot in a carriage drawn by two horses, one of which was limping and ill, and they would just leave that one. Also, when the zoo was bombed, a lot of the animals were killed, so they butchered them. And they gave a lot of the meat away to the poor in the city, and they kept some. At a certain point, they had to figure out ways to make sure the zoo would stay open because they needed it to hide the refugees. So they persuaded the Germans that they needed to have a pig farm on the zoo grounds. But that also meant that they had pork to eat, too. And then when, for various reasons, the pig farm disappeared, they persuaded the Germans that they had to have, like, little garden plots that were made available to people in the city. So then they were able to raise vegetables. They just kept piecing things together. And oddly enough, even their housekeeper didn't figure out that they were hiding people. I don't know how. Antonina didn't know how, but the housekeeper would go away and say, these are very crazy people. They ask for seconds and thirds and fourths and fifths, and they have endless appetites. But of course, what was happening is that they were taking the food, they were giving it to their young son, and they were saying things like, oh, I wonder if the lions need to be fed. Oh, I think maybe the bears are hungry or something like that. And they were correct that no one would suspect a child that young of being part of the underground.
I can't believe that they would have enough food when the ghetto was starving and the condition people were dying in the streets, and particularly when the uprising came. How many people did they have refuge for at one time?
50, which is... an enormous amount.
They survived during the uprising?
They survived. Everybody, all but two people survived the war out of 300 people. You know, theirs was essentially a stop on an underground railroad. They didn't want people to have to spend the whole war with them. A few people had to, but they didn't want that to be. Theirs was just one stop on their way to the outlying manors and farmlands, and from there out of the country. And the people who did stay with them, though, all survived, except for two who died of illness.
Is there any other another question on this side? How about down here? Sorry, there's no photographs. Nothing. Thanks.
Did you have an opportunity to interview the son, who I believe is still alive?
He is still alive. I met him. He's like 77. To me, he looked seven. You know, he was 6 feet tall, but I looked at him, and I couldn't get past his being about that big the whole time. I had with me my friend Magda and her daughter. So Magda, who's closer to me in age, had a better sense of etiquette and everything than her daughter, who grew up in America. So Magda was talking with Rish and trying to explain why this crazy American was writing about his family. And Magda's daughter was furiously translating and taking notes. And so we were visiting with him. And he said, "Why would you be interested in writing about my parents? What was so special?" And I said, "Well, don't you think this was a very unusual life?" He said, "It was the only life I knew. For me, it was a completely normal life." that was all.
Now, they have been recognized at Yad Vashem, right?
They have. They've been recognized as righteous.
Because I have had the experience in the book I've been working on about Poland that some of the survivors that I've interviewed would not, they did not want me to meet their rescuers for fear that they would still be in danger at this late date, even though
yes.
I assured them. And one of the things that Gunnar Paulsen points out is that there are more poles in the line of trees at Yad Vashem. The Holocaust Memorial in Israel has a line of trees for the righteous Gentiles, for the rescuers, and there are more poles, there are more trees planted for poles than for any other country. But there would probably be many more because a lot of people were not recognized.
Yes, and I think that was for several reasons. One reason is that you have to just remember what happens to kids, teenagers, young adults whose brains are still really forming during wartime when they're taught that they dare not tell anybody anything. You know, paranoia is really the only sane thing to indulge in at that point. And I imagine it's very hard to lose that and you still think that indeed you're going to be found out or they're going to be found out. But then also the Soviets came in after the war, and it really was not popular to be a freedom fighter then either.
Well, the resistance fighters were also, they were actually Stroop, who was one of the commanders in the ghetto, was, have you read Conversations with an Executioner?
No, I haven't read that.
Someone told me.
I know of it.
Yeah, he was imprisoned, so this German, the commander in the Warsaw Ghetto was put into the same cell with a Polish resistance fighter who actually had the presence of mind. He was a journalist to interview him about...
Amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, there were many reasons why they would be very worried about it.
Question back there?
Hi. You mentioned in two places in your book that Jan and Antonina
yes.
Carried with them cyanide pills
mm-hmm.
and planned to take them if they were in dire circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But what provisions had they made for the son in case they had to take these pills?
I don't know. I don't know. I only recently made contact with the daughter and found her. She's living in Scandinavia. So there are still some questions that I haven't been able to answer.
Mm-hmm.
After the war, Antonina died in 1971. Jan lived for 3 years after that, and when he was very ill in his last days, he went to Israel. And he stayed and was with and was taken care of by some of the people who had sheltered with him at the zoo.
Thank you.
Any questions over here? How about back up there?
Thank you. This story sounds utterly fascinating, but I'm slightly diverted by the thing you mentioned at the beginning, the primeval forest full of ancient animals, and I'm hoping you'll tell us a little more about that. And does it tie in at all with, I don't know if you know this new book called Horse Chariot Language, about the dissemination of Proto-Indo-European from Central Asia and Central Europe?
I don't know that book. I'm probably mispronouncing the name of the forest, but
Paulina, you can help us out. How do you say it correctly?
How do you say it correctly?
The mic's right there.
I say Białowieża. What do you say?
Białowieża. You're very close.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You've been there?
Yeah, of course.
It's gorgeous,
it's beautiful.
Isn't it?
It's gorgeous.
But you can't just go, right? Because you have to have special permission to go. It's
like national park.
I see.
Very well preserved, and part of it belongs to Poland, part to Belarus.
Yes, so source of
it's
many conflicts.
Different conditions in Poland, I mean the proper one, and it's completely different on the other side of the border.
Yes, yeah. And that is a problem because, of course, the animals, you know, don't pay attention to the border lines. And I know there are at least one environmentalist there, and there's a lot of people who are trying to make sure that it stays preserved. But it's just one of those crazy paradoxes that Hitler decided that forest was going to be this mythic, pristine hunting preserve, royal hunting preserve. It was that really helped to make sure that it survived the war. Because, you know, it makes you wonder how come it really wasn't destroyed the way so much was. But nope, had to be looked after and kept pristine. And in fact, now I think even airplanes are not allowed to fly over it, except maybe a mile above it or something like that, because they don't want the noise pollution or any pollution at all. And there are places where you have to be silent when you walk through it.
Yes. Paulina, another question? Oh, another.
It's one of the most extraordinary places on Earth. Yeah.
I would like to add one detail to this. In fact, there is a something which I was taught in my school, that your bisons are coming from this part of Europe. When 12,000 years ago, there was a Iceland era, and there was a connection between Asia and North American continent through this very north part of this part of the world. They were wandering from this part of Europe. So There is a kind of connection between those...
An important connection.
Yes.
Bisons, because there are living bisons over there in Białowieża.
We don't think of bison running through forests. You know, we think of them on the plains, but they are related.
Okay. Yeah. Right there?
Actually, two questions. One is, I just am curious about finding a little bit more detail about finding the original diary from Antonio and what it was actually like to read it, you know, have it translated and read. And then I'm just curious if you were able to or tried to speak with anyone who, you know, was at the zoo during the war, was, you know, refugee there for a while and then moved on to somewhere else, and a little bit of any of those stories.
I haven't been able to find anyone who hid there. So if you encounter anyone who did, please have them get in touch with me. I would just love to find out what happened to them. So I wasn't able to do that. I was able to talk to people who went to the zoo before the war, just to visit it in different ways. And as I say, these two elderly women who went to the zoo on their work for the underground, but nobody who actually hid there. Finding her diary, I really just was in a state of cold thrill for so long.
How many copies do you think there were in existence? I mean, left in bookstores in Poland? I mean, That was amazing.
I have no idea. That could be the only one. I don't know. But in the diary itself, she jumps around a great deal. It's not really in sequence. So, and she doesn't have all of her dates correct because, you know, you're keeping a diary. And so I had to confirm a lot of things and try to get things in the right order. But it was enchanting. And then when I met Rish, he loaned me one of his mom's children's books, which I had translated. I was able to read that, which was quite wonderful, and gave me some other documents that were interviews, things by his dad, and photographs. The zoo has quite a few photographs in its archives. And the gentleman who is now the director of the zoo was a little boy who volunteered at the zoo when Jan was in charge and remembers him as being very strict, you know, and a very good zookeeper. And when this man was a little boy, he told Jan that when he grew up, he was going to be a zookeeper. I've met the new zookeeper's wife.
That's fantastic. Diane, do you have animals?
I don't have any because I travel.
You travel.
And I feel that it would be unfair, really. There was a time when
not
I had
like a small ferret in your bag back there?
Except for the small marsupials, yes. Of course, there are all the inner animals
of course.
At one point, I had 23 cats, a rabbit, and a dog in a small apartment when I was an undergraduate. That was interesting.
And maybe...
and a roommate.
And a roommate.
Yes.
I have time for maybe two more questions. How about one here?
Hi. I was wondering, when you say they hid in plain sight in the, cages of the ants, I'd like to find out exactly how that would work. How would they hide? And did they get caught at all?
No.
At the end? Okay.
It was absolutely amazing that they didn't. The cages and the habitats tend to have like a little room in the back, and there'll be like a little toilet. It'll be barely heated, you know. There might be some running water there. The pheasant's cage, very, very small. But Jan wisely had dug a tunnel leading from the pheasant's cage, which was about where the booth is, about that distance, back up there, the film booth, to here, from the main house. And so they could sneak people in like that. I don't think that it was the most comfortable place in the world, but what was wonderful is that they would bring them out after nightfall. But they also knew, all the different tricks of camouflage that animals indulged in. And, of course, the best way to camouflage people was more people. So they would make a point of inviting every legal friend, relative, neighbor they could think of, and their house was just packed with people, with turmoil, with changing people, people singing, people doing things. And so it wasn't noticed quite so much when somebody would sneak out, you know, and be in the living room, maybe. Yeah.
Amazing to contemplate. Right here. One sec. No, we need the microphone.
Okay.
I was just wondering if anybody, since your book has been out, if any of the people that hid in the downstairs, if they've contacted you or if their children remember stories.
One woman contacted me to tell me that she was in a geography class that Jan had taught after the war. And it was through her that I found out that he had gone to Israel. She had found that out from her aunt. But nobody who actually was at the villa has been in touch. But I'm still hopeful. You know, they moved to so many different countries. I kept trying to track them down, but people changed their names, of course.
They told stories of when they were, you know, in there to their children.
I'm hoping I will hear.
I think you will.
The book is coming out in different languages. I would just love to know.
And there's going to be a Polish translation soon, right?
There will be a Polish translation next year. And I'm trying to make arrangements to meet the daughter. I very much want to be able to ask her what her mom smelled like, you know, how she wore her hair and She had gestures that she remembered and things like that. And there are those things that moms tell their daughters that they don't tell their sons. When I asked Rish these questions, he mainly said average, you know, just normal, average, those kinds of things. And I thought, yeah, well, I think sometimes moms reveal to daughters what it was that attracted them, you know, in their husband and things like that. I'd like to know.
Diane, it seems like this book brought together so many of your interests and your extraordinary skill. It must be one of your most satisfying.
It absolutely was. It was a gift for me to find it because it allowed me to bring my natural history tendencies and my poet's heart. And for many years, I don't know if people know, but I was that anonymous voice on suicide prevention hotline that was called in my part of New York. And so I'm very interested in the different ways in which neighbors help neighbors. And for a long time, I felt that we have a faulty idea of what a hero really is, unfortunately. We think of heroes in terms of combat only and violence. We don't think of heroes as people who can perform subversive acts of compassion, and that is very heroic too. And it's time that really we had those kinds of role models as well, especially because I'm convinced that there are people like this now all over the world who are performing acts of mercy and heroism for their neighbors, and we just don't hear about them.
Well, it's a gift for us that this story came to you, and thank you so much for tonight. Thank you all for coming.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.